Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to talk about air quality in and around Kansas City. Later in the show, as part of our Tell KCUR series, we'll hear what our listeners think Kansas City can learn from the events in Ferguson, Missouri. But for now, let's go ahead and dive right into the air quality issue. With me live in the talk studio this morning are several experts here to share what they know. Amanda Grayer is here with us from the Mid-America Regional Council, where she works as the Air Quality Program Manager. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
We've heard some news about a triangular-shaped section of town near downtown that is not currently meeting federal air quality standards. The precise language is that this is a non-attainment area. Can you tell us what that means and exactly what part of town we're talking about?
Sure. So there's a portion of downtown Kansas City, Missouri, in Jackson County that has been designated what is called non-attainment, or not attaining the federal standard specifically for sulfur dioxide. So there are six criteria pollutants, or pollutants that the EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency has set health-based standards for, and sulfur dioxide is one of those six. So the non-attainment area is from the state line to 435 and from the Missouri River to the I-670, I-70 line. So it's a very small portion of Jackson County. The reason that this is so small, so a lot of times when you're talking about air quality in Kansas City, you're talking about ozone pollution. Ozone is another one of those six criteria pollutants. So the ozone boundary is actually five counties. It's Jackson, Clay, and Platte counties in Missouri, and Johnson and Wyandotte counties in Kansas. And we talk about ozone alert days and how far ozone pollution travels and that kind of thing. SO2 as a pollutant behaves very differently from ozone.
SO2, that's sulfur
dioxide. Behaves very differently from ozone pollution. So that's why the non-attainment boundary is so much smaller for that particular pollutant. So the Missouri Department of Natural Resources and the Kansas Department of Health and Environment work together to figure out what sources are contributing to that non-attainment. So it's monitored. There's a monitor in that area that registered levels that were above a new standard that was set in 2010.
So sulfur dioxide and ozone, are those the two primary pollutants that people in Kansas City should be thinking about?
Really, ozone is the primary pollutant. And then particulate matter is another one. So between ozone, particulate matter, and sulfur dioxide, those are really the three that that Kansas City deals with in varying levels in different areas.
What is particulate matter?
It's very tiny particle pollution, and it's another one of those six criteria pollutants. So we've gotten to three of the six already, and it's measured by size. And so you'll hear either PM2.5, which refers to the size of the particle, or PM10. And so PM10 would be 10 microns across. I mean, these are really tiny particles. PM2.5 would be 2.5 microns across. And the smaller the particle, the more dangerous it is. It can get deeper into your lungs and possibly be absorbed into the bloodstream. And that's why particulate matter has health-based standards that are set for it.
And Craig Voland is here. He's the chair of the Air Quality Committee for the Kansas Sierra Club. He's an environmental scientist who specializes in the issues of our region. And Craig, what are the implications of the situation Amanda just laid out? How would you characterize our air quality and how it's affecting us?
Well, I think she characterized it pretty well. We have occasional ozone exceedances, and when I mean exceedance, that isn't necessarily a violation of the standard, but it's a complicated calculation as far as violation. But every time you have an exceedance, you are possibly sending somebody with asthma to the hospital, even though it's not a violation. So these exceedances are important. This particular case for sulfur dioxide, it acts a lot like ozone in that it affects people's breathing, respiratory system. It's dangerous to asthmatics. And keep in mind, asthma is something that can have an instantaneous impact because they can have an attack. So it's really important that we deal with this issue. In fact, just before I came here, I was reading the New York Times from yesterday, and there was a big article in there about how the downtown Kansas City, this is in the New York Times, mind you, how it's coming back so strong and all the people are coming back to live.
All right, I saw that article.
Yeah, well, you know, this isn't really good news that the air sulfur dioxide is in non-attainment in downtown. So I think it's something we have to really address as soon as possible.
That's something that I'm curious about, that the air quality can be of a problematic level in such a small, specific area, because
air kind of floats around us. It's not contained in specific areas. When the wind blows, air moves, or at least that's how I perceive it. Can you explain how air quality in one neighborhood does or doesn't affect air quality in another neighborhood?
Well, it's a spectrum, and I think Amanda really should address this. It has to do with where your monitors are located.
Well, it has to do with where the monitors are located, and it really also has to do with which pollutant you're talking about. So when you say air quality, there are a lot of different pollutants and air toxics and different things in the air, and some of them travel farther than others. And so you can see the effects of smoke or ozone pollution reaching other metro areas, reaching hundreds of miles away. When you see sulfur dioxide, it can be a very short distance away that it's already, to simplify it, sort of fallen out of the air. Particulate matter doesn't travel as far as ozone does either. So it's really pollutant specific. And that's why there are monitors. We have 8 ozone monitors in the area, all the way from Trimble up in Clinton County, all the way down to Heritage Park and Richards Gebauer, south of the metro in Cass County and Johnson County, to measure what's coming in and what's going out. And so when you talk about air quality, it really depends on which pollutant you're talking about, where the air can be very different from one neighborhood to the next.
How do you measure air quality?
There are a system of air quality monitors that are set up around the region, and some of them measure multiple pollutants, and some of them are more specific to one or two pollutants. And that is the state air agencies. So the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has their Air Pollution Control Program. The Kansas Department of Health and Environment has their Bureau of Air. And those agencies work with EPA to figure out where to site these monitors. So they're picking up these 6 criteria pollutants. The health-based standards are called National Ambient Air Quality Standards. So they're trying to measure the ambient air pollution, not necessarily from a particular source, but what everyone is generally breathing in a regional area. So these monitors are sited in locations based on meteorology, based on prevailing winds, based on what sources are in the area. So they're not being triggered by any one particular source, but they're truly measuring the blend of all of the sources and getting at what the health of the air quality is in various parts of the metro.
So based on that, how do you think Kansas City's air quality kind of measures up by comparison to other similar-sized cities in the United States?
Well, obviously the closest comparison we've got, St. Louis, just on the other side of the state, is actually designated non-attainment for both ozone and particulate matter. And I believe they have an SO2, a sulfur dioxide non-attainment area that they're dealing with as well. Places like Omaha, Wichita, they're in the same boat that we are in terms of teetering right on the edge of non-attainment for ozone and then dealing with event or source-specific spikes for other pollutants, but generally attaining all federal standards.
So, Craig, when you were talking about this New York Times article about young people coming to live in Kansas City's downtown and that this is a renaissance we're seeing, you mentioned that this concerns you that at the same time downtown is in this non-attainment situation, especially with sulfur dioxide. What do you think, what is the right response to this as far as if you're a person interested in living downtown, should this be something you think twice about? Is it that serious?
Well, if I was asthmatic, I would think twice about it because sulfur dioxide does have that effect at a short time interval. But I think this new standard that they're working off of came in 2010, so that's 4 years ago, and they are working on it. There's this steam plant, which is right in the middle of this, is burning coal, which is a particularly bad place to be burning coal, and it has a very short stack. The height of your stack is one of the most important variables in determining what happens.
You're talking about the Veolia power plant?
Correct.
A lot of people have been pointing to that as a source of the emissions that are causing this air pollution in Kansas City. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I would say that mainly because it is in where it's located plus the shortness of these stacks. A big power plant would have a 600-foot stack. I'm not sure what those are, but just I'd say they couldn't be more than 150.
Well, and on that, I might add, so the new standard did come out for sulfur dioxide in 2010. And based on the Clean Air Act, EPA is required to review all of these standards for those 6 criteria pollutants every 5 years. They're not required to change them every 5 years, but they're required every 5 years to review research and science and figure out if the current standard is still adequately protecting public health. So the sulfur dioxide standard was changed in 2010. I believe the 70s were the last time that standard had been updated. So that particular plant had been operating at their permitted levels and was attaining the previous standard. And so it's not necessarily that air quality, that the sulfur dioxide levels have gone up. It's just that the standard changed. And so they're doing more to reduce those sulfur dioxide emissions. And the state of Missouri has been working with that plant and other sources outside that boundary, including KCP&L plants, Independence Power and Light, the Kansas side sources with BPU, to reduce the overall sulfur emissions. And there's other federal rules coming in related to boilers and other things that are all working together overall to reduce sulfur emissions. So I anticipate we would see a significant reduction in the sulfur dioxide in the area within a matter of years. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight, but it within a matter of years, I would imagine we would see a pretty significant reduction in sulfur dioxide.
Other than sulfur dioxide, are there, just in the big picture, are there other issues related to air quality that people in our area should be thinking about?
Well, the ozone has been a real struggle. There again, the standard was reduced, I believe, in 2006 to what it now is, and they're now considering the health science suggests that the standard should be even lower than it is now. And I think they're going to announce something within the next 6 months or so.
EPA is on a court-ordered timeline to announce a new standard by December of this year and finalize that standard by October of next year.
Right. And we're marginal. I think we're at marginal attainment or non-attainment at the moment.
We are considered attainment for ozone at the moment.
Right. But we had a violation, I think, last year. But it depends on the weather a lot, and this has been a cool summer up until today, that is. So it may go back in attainment for that reason. But still, we've got some work to do, and that has to do with really transportation sources more than anything else, I think, now.
Explain that.
Well, I think it's the emissions from cars. I used to say, if you had asked me this 10 years ago, I'd say it was emissions from power plants and other things were causing the ozone. But right now, I'd say it's probably becoming more transportation sources.
Did you change your mind or has the big picture changed as far as you see it?
Well, over time, one of the main components of ozone are the oxides of nitrogen. And a lot of the big power plants have installed what is called DNOx, meaning taking the NOx down a lot. So I think there's been improvements that way. So I think, and we'll talk about this later, I think, when we get into transportation, that's the real frontier for air quality is where we're getting. Now, that doesn't address the subject of climate change. I'm just talking about conventional pollutants.
Interesting. Well, how do you think that people should respond on days when they hear, like, there's an ozone alert day or the ozone levels are high? What should people be doing with that kind of information just in their daily lives?
Well, I think Amanda's the one there.
So when the Mid-America Regional Council is the one who issues an ozone alert, and we work with meteorologists to determine if the pollutants coming in from elsewhere and the weather conditions are going to be conducive to higher ozone levels that might impact public health. And so when you hear an ozone alert comes out, what we really encourage people to do is reduce driving if possible. If they have existing respiratory conditions like asthma or emphysema, to stay inside in a well-ventilated area, for people to reduce their physical exertion outside, so maybe go for a shorter run than you plan to or put off the yard work for another day. We encourage
people. It sounds like a health trade-off, like to address one aspect of your health, you're going to maybe, like, exercise is good for your health.
Sure.
But then you've got to go on a shorter run because of the ozone levels.
I mean, yeah, if the ozone levels are higher, there is an adverse impact on health. And generally healthy people, so the SkyCast, which is what we base the ozone alerts on, it goes green, yellow, orange, red. And at an orange level is when we issue an ozone alert. So green, the air is generally going to be healthy. Yellow, people with existing conditions may be a little bit uncomfortable. Orange is when people with existing conditions should certainly stay inside, but generally healthy people are probably okay outside on those days. If we start seeing a high orange or into a red, that's when otherwise healthy people might feel impacts. And sometimes those impacts can mimic allergies. You'll feel a little bit wheezy or just short of breath. And there's a lot of science and research that's done on the health impacts of that. And children and the elderly are really the most susceptible groups to that. So when we talk about this stuff, the main target demographics that we're targeting these messages at are really parents of small children and the elderly.
Just I want to add, when you look long term, though, all of these problems are based on the burning of fossil fuels, so that in the longer term, we need to start going to renewable energy and solar and wind. And for a person's response here is to begin promoting that or even using solar panels.
Well, Craig, Amanda, stick around while we take a short break. Central Standard returns in just a moment, and when we do, we'll hear more about air quality in Kansas City. We'll also meet a concerned citizen who independently took it upon herself to start measuring air pollution in specific places around town. That's coming right up. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I've been talking with Amanda Greyer of the Mid-America Regional Council and Craig Volin, chair of the Air Quality Committee for the Kansas Sierra Club. We're talking about how air pollution affects our communities and our lives. We want to hear from you. Does air quality impact your life? If so, how? Call us at 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. That number again is 816-235-2888. Now I'd like to turn to Leticia DeCaney. Leticia, you measure air quality, but I understand you're not a scientist or anything like that. You're just a concerned citizen.
Correct.
How would you describe your project? What do you do and why?
Well, what I've done is I've gathered information, try to get a group of our community people to who are concerned about pollution in our air, and as I'm reaching out, educating them as well on how diesel can impact someone's health. As Amanda explained, the ultrafine particles will go into your bloodstream and can cause a lot of serious illnesses. And as I'm going around talking to people and asking about concerns, we definitely have a concern in our area in the Argentine Turner neighborhoods. We have one of the largest rail yards in the United States there. And there are a lot of children and elderly around there that are affected by their health.
Explain more about that.
Well, as I'm going around asking people, they are telling me how they've had asthma, how there's been deaths in their family that they don't realize what happened. For example, one gentleman told me how his mother was outside, you know, doing yard work. She never missed a day of work. And, you know, the next morning for breakfast, she wasn't doing well. And suddenly she was in a coma, and he never got to speak to her again. And the doctors never knew how that happened. And so with the pollution in her, he thinks now that he's educated, this is probably one of the reasons why she had passed. And so right now what we're doing is we're monitoring around the area in residents' homes and businesses that allow us to set up a monitor for 24 hours.
How do you do that? Here you are, this person without specialized knowledge. How do you get the tools you needed, and what inspired you?
Well, I am passionate about health and prevention. So I attended a meeting not knowing what I was going for. I just knew I was going to welcome people that were coming into our Argentine Community Center to talk about, I didn't know what at first. But when I saw that there were a group of people, they were from different cities, talking about what they did to reduce the pollution in their cities, it just made much sense that if we can do something in our area, then I would like to be involved. And I honestly didn't even think about the railroad because I've always lived next to them. It's just part of nature that I just thought, okay, it's there. You know, I'm used to it. I mean, when I was a kid, it would rock me to sleep. And but now being educated, which I didn't know how much it affected our health, I thought, well, this is something that I need to get more people involved and get a committee together to learn more about it and who are concerned to get more involved.
How does the railroad affect air quality?
Well, it's the engines produce the diesel, and I think Craig has more experts.
Right. Well, It's mainly the idling of diesel engines. The practice has been they're starting to improve it, but the practice has been that you just keep these engines idling for hours. If you ever drive by there, you see this. I've driven by where I thought there was a fire going on, but it turned out that one of their engines was just underneath the bridge. And that's a serious problem. The latest testing has, I think, credibly shown that some of these diesel emissions are getting into this neighborhood. The data was very consistent with the direction of the wind. So I think we need to do more testing there to be more conclusive. But breathing diesel fumes is just not good. There's going to be the science is in the last 10 years has developed more and more that diesel is a toxic air pollutant and even is considered a carcinogen.
I want to mention, so in 2008, the EPA came out with the Diesel Emission Reduction Act was signed, and there's been funding specifically targeted at reducing diesel emissions nationwide since then. And we've done a number of projects in Kansas City, and we've worked specifically with rail companies, including BNSF and Kansas City Southern and Norfolk Southern, to install. So the switch engines in the yards, one of the big things they do is they do idle waiting for a job and sometimes for hours at a time. And one of the pluses and minuses of diesel engines is that they last forever. So some of these switch engines were from the 50s and 60s using technology from 50 years ago because the engines still worked. So one of the things that we've done that Mark has worked with the rail companies and our state air agencies to do is implement these projects on the rail yard. So there's these devices called automatic start-stop devices, and it's kind of like on a Prius, right, where the engine shuts off when the vehicle is stopped at a light. These devices, if the switch engine idles for longer than a set period of time, it shuts the engine down, and it's just a push-button start to get it started again. And part of the reason they would idle for so long is because it was a complicated process to get the engine restarted. So there's devices like that that are not only saving fuel, so the rail companies are interested in it because they're reducing their fuel costs by not idling, but also significantly reducing the pollution from those switch engines. And I know the state of Kansas has worked with in the Argentine yard specifically, there's at least four new locomotives in that yard. It's a process. You know, it doesn't again happen overnight. But there have been a lot of projects, both focusing on rail, and we focused on school buses actually since 2007. You know, we're talking about children, and we've done a lot of work to clean up the school bus fleet in Kansas City. Hundreds and hundreds of buses have been retrofitted or converted to CNG or propane, CNG compressed natural gas or propane, to reduce the emissions that are idling around children every day.
That is fascinating. I want to get back to all of your feedback, both Craig and Amanda, to Leticia's observations. But Leticia, let's get back to you. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what originally inspired you? And you mentioned that you're passionate about health. What inspired that passion?
My son passed away 2 years ago from cancer. And I've learned a lot through my journey, and mainly nutrition, but I know environmental, and there's a lot of other aspects that are involved. And so I figured this is one way I can help out the community, considering we have a lot of children in our neighborhood. I'd rather start from the source of where it's coming from than wait till somebody has to be treated for an illness that they have.
When you go around measuring air quality, where do you do your readings and how do you do them? Can you explain to us how it works? Because most of us are like you, like before you started this, we aren't picturing anything in our heads when someone says they're measuring air quality.
Well, when we started monitoring, we just kind of went to the neighbors that were closest to the rail yard. And we also we look at the wind. At first, the wind wasn't cooperating with us, but we thought, okay, well, let's just see if it's swirling around. So,
you mean you just look at the wind with your naked eye?
No. I look on weather.com to get the wind direction. That's one way. I look up the information specifically to the area where we're at, and there's just some data that we get from the website. And we've noticed some results even up on the hill where we thought, oh, we're not going to get any measurements here, but...
But when you say get measurements, what are you talking about?
Well, when I measure, I put a monitor out for 24 hours at a resident's house. And after we collect so many of, we have a filter on there that is capturing the diesel particles, like as if it was your human lung. what would get trapped. And I would send off, after I gather so many, to the lab. Then the lab will send the information to the Global Community Monitor, where our scientists will give us the interpretation, and that's where we get our results. And he explains it to us where we understand. And
does it commonly happen that the reading that you take in one location differs dramatically from another, or are they pretty consistent?
They could be. It just kind of depends. I mean, some, you know, in the winter, there's not as many leaves out. So, and I think in the summer, the trees do help, you know, with the greenery as well. But the wind direction, definitely, we can tell with the, you know, if it's coming through where there's mostly the engine where they're worked on. That's where we usually get a lot of the readings coming from, the engine yard.
Has the knowledge you've gained about air quality in specific neighborhoods in Kansas City changed the way you navigate the city?
Not necessarily navigate the city, no.
Anything else about your behavior that's changed, or even your attitude?
This is something that I want to continue to work on and to help clean up our air. So, not necessarily. I just make sure I'm not outside near the rail yard. You know, I'd rather go for my jog further away.
And Amanda Greer of the Mid-America Regional Council, does anything about Leticia's story especially catch your interest? Anything you want to respond to other than what we've already discussed?
Well, I think that monitoring is a really expensive prospect. And so that's part of the reason that you see only 8 ozone monitors in the region. So these monitors that are put up by the state air agencies and EPA are very expensive to operate because they are in these small buildings that are humidity and temperature controlled to guarantee that all of the results can be compared to one another and the data can be quality assured and all of this. And so there's a lot of opportunities for the community-based monitoring like Leticia is doing. And really what I'm most excited about is that the community is getting engaged in it, because air quality, when you're talking about this stuff and you start getting into acronyms and federal language, you know, it can get overwhelming or boring very quickly. And so to have a community being engaged on the topic is exciting to me. It not only makes my work easier because, you know, if I mention air quality to somebody in that neighborhood, they'll know what I'm talking about already. So it's easier to talk about other pollutants and other sources when they're already engaged on one air quality concern. And if everybody was as concerned and engaged on air quality, then that would be the ultimate goal, right? Is it, you know, obviously air quality impacts everyone, whether they realize it or not. Everyone breathes. If you stop breathing, that's a problem. So pollutants.
I would say so.
Right, right. So pollutants impact everyone, whether they're actively thinking about it or not. So engaged communities, I think, are very important.
Well, we're going to talk now, speaking of the importance of breathing, with a doctor, a pulmonologist, about what our lungs do with all this stuff in our air. We'll also take your calls at 816-235-2888. Let's turn now to Dr. Vincent Lem. He is with us from Children's Mercy Hospital. Good morning, Dr. Lem.
Yeah, hello. And actually, I'm with you from St. Luke's Hospital.
Oh, St. Luke's. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, not the Children's Hospital. That's okay.
Well, our lungs are built to do a certain amount of air filtration, are they not?
That is correct.
How does it work? We breathe in air through our noses and mouths, then what?
Okay, so we're breathing in the air, or ambient air, which is roughly 21% oxygen and 78% nitrogen with, you know, a mixture of other gases that probably as a whole in normal amounts aren't important. But the oxygen is the breathe into the lungs. It's actually a lot of the particulate matter in the air is being filtered or cleaned through our nasal passages, our upper airways. So that helps somewhat cleanse and humidifies the air as the air is introduced in our lungs.
Is that what nose hair is for?
In part, it really is to catch a lot of particulate matter and protect our airways from getting too much, you know, abnormal material into our lower tract. That is correct.
Long-standing right. question
course,
answered. Thank you.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. So then the oxygen that enters our lower tract is passively diffused. It just gets passed into the capillaries, the blood vessels in our lungs, and then the oxygen goes into the rest of our system as it's pumped by our hearts through the blood vessels. The carbon dioxide that comes back from our venous system then is also passively diffused into our lungs, and as we expel or exhale gas, and then it's breathed out into the atmosphere.
What happens when there's too much stuff in our air for the lungs to clean it all back out? What happens then, and is that a realistic scenario?
Right. So though our lungs are very good and our body's protective mechanisms are very good at handling some degree of abnormal material that we are exposed to, you can overwhelm our host defenses. And so if we breathe in too much bad particulate matter or toxic gases, then the tissue actually gets a breakdown, and the tissue breakdown then starts causing lung injury.
So that's the lung tissue.
Right, the lung tissue and the lung passages, correct.
And do the contaminants also pass from our lungs into the bloodstream through the oxygen that's been cleaned in our lungs?
Correct. Now, the particulate matter, the material that's non-gaseous, will be retained in the airways, in the tissue of the lungs. So, for example, when people smoke and they get a lot of soot and particulate matter from the tar, that material is deposited in the lungs. So we can see that at surgery or in autopsies or lung resection tissue, the dark, sooty material. But the gases, material is, can a lot of it be absorbed into the blood vessels, just like the oxygen is.
When you work with patients and you are sort of exposed to all of the effects of various materials that pass through their lungs and their air passages, what are you seeing? Do you see anything noteworthy in Kansas City patients in particular?
As a lung doctor, the largest problem we see with inhalation of toxic material obviously comes from people who smoke. So, you know, we're always trying to caution, counsel, advise people against inhalation of a lot of the carcinogen gases.
Voluntary pollution.
Yeah, voluntary. Voluntary, though. When someone is addicted to nicotine and cigarette smoking, they will tell you it's not that voluntary.
Yeah. Good
and
point.
I can sympathize with that. Clearly, I can sympathize with them. But regarding air pollution, which I think was what I heard a little bit being discussed before I came on the air, a lot of that material, you know, is being regulated by the Clean Air Act. And that material, which are air constituents of air pollutants, are actually breathed into the lungs as well. And a lot of those gases can actually get absorbed into the body. A lot of those noxious gases can also cause a lot of tissue damage as it contacts the nasal mucosa and the lung membranes.
As far as the body is concerned, is there such a thing as a quote-unquote normal amount of air pollution? I mean, there's a sort of normal standard that's within, you know, government regulatory bodies' policies, but does the human body accept a normal amount of air pollution?
You know, and that's a great question, and I don't think I can answer it, nor do I think anyone in the scientific community can clearly answer that. But you're absolutely correct. The government has set reasonably standards that they thought or feel is healthy for the body. You know, and there's an air quality index that you may have talked about earlier today that measures how much particulate matter, how much of the air pollutants are in the air at any one time, particularly in the urban areas. And they have listed by amounts and graded by a color coding that you may be familiar with as to what is considered healthy, what is considered maybe somewhat unhealthy to people that have underlying lung or heart disease and to children, and amount that clearly is unhealthy to everyone that is exposed to that concentration. Even that so-called healthy or green zone is debatable as to whether that is causing some degree of damage. But at least the government, in their studies that they can review, feels that that's at least tolerable by the body.
And I have one more question for you before we let you go. How do you think Kansas Cityans should adapt their behavior in response to those air quality index readings, especially when they are at the orange or red level? Are there measures that people can do to, can take to protect their own respiratory health?
Yeah, I think there are, and particularly as a lung doctor, you know, we are much more cautious in advising our pulmonary patients regarding what they can do to protect themselves during orange or red alert times. You know, luckily, we're not in Beijing, China, right, where the air quality index is like over 200. So in Kansas City, our readings are generally in the 40s to 70s, which is normally in a green to yellow zone range. So we're pretty clean reasonably here in the Midwest. But nevertheless, when the air gets hot, when there's a lot of sunshine, and we do produce a fair amount of more smog or ozone, that degree of toxic material can cause airway symptoms to our asthmatics and our patients that have, you know, significant emphysema. So it's usually the worst during the hottest, sunniest time of the day. So if people need to go outdoors, if they have airways disease, we advise that they do not go outdoors during the middle of the afternoon, but maybe retain their outdoor activities or morning or later evenings. Wearing masks really doesn't help.
Interesting.
Yeah, because a lot of that particulate material is fine and would go through the pores of the standard mask that people wear, and certainly they do not protect you from the gases, from the carbon monoxide or from the sulfur dioxide and some of the other air pollutants that we measure. Plus, when people have lung disease, wearing a mask restricts their breathing, and they actually feel very uncomfortable breathing through a mask. So I usually advise my lung patients against wearing a mask. Now, if you're healthy and can tolerate wearing a mask in the restrictive effect, then I think that might be reasonable.
Okay, Dr. Lem, thank you so much. That is such helpful information. Dr. Vincent Lem of St. Luke's Hospital, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
And we will be right back to continue this conversation about air pollution, as well as to check in on our Tell KCUR segment. Central Standards taking a short break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Amanda Greer of the Mid-America Regional Council and Craig Voland of the Kansas Sierra Club. Welcome back to both of you. And welcome back to Leticia DeCaney, who keeps her own measure of Kansas City's air quality. We've asked you how air quality impacts your life, and we've got a call at 816-235-2888 from Billy in South Kansas City. Hi, Billy.
Hello. I just wanted to comment that I lived in New York City almost 40 years and saw the air quality change there. When I would fly in and fly into the city, it was so covered with smog you could not see it really. And then I lived right near Lincoln Center, and the tour buses would sit there with their engines running while the people would, so the driver would be in air conditioned. But the people were making tours of Lincoln Center and so forth. And that was all over the city, these big buses sitting there. And when you would fly out, you'd see smoke belching from the apartment houses from coal. So the city made an ordinance that they could not burn coal anymore. I think that's what it was. And I had developed asthma, and my husband at that time had a heart condition. And there would be times when they would say, you don't go out, and you'd have to stay confined in your apartment because the air quality was so bad. And then after they changed the rules and the buses couldn't run, you know, while they were just sitting there idly, and I remember flying back in, and the city was clear. You could see it, and which was amazing. That was after a couple of years of the laws had changed.
Thank you so much, Billy.
I wanted to say that, you know, I see the big trucks here sitting out, and the guys having lunch sitting in their air-conditioned cabs, and their engines running, and I think that should be a no-no.
Well, let's talk to our guest. There are a couple of things in Billy's call that I want to talk about. One is that she seems to be really making a case that laws matter.
Oh, I think they do, and I think we've had some improvement. But the new frontier, in my opinion, is diesel emissions that have not been really directly or systematically addressed. They are not monitored systematically. And so I'm glad she called in and pointed that out, because there's no excuse for meaningless idling of diesel engines.
So I will note, actually, that in Kansas City, in that air quality boundary that I mentioned for ozone, there is a diesel idling regulation at the state level that legally limits the amount of time that a heavy-duty diesel engine can idle at a warehouse or a pickup or drop-off facility. Part of that problem is if the logistics of a warehousing facility are bad, then trucks are forced to sit there and wait for a bay to open up or things like that. And so this regulation does limit heavy-duty diesel idling. And now the problem is enforcement of that, right? So there's not somebody sitting there waiting for that idling to happen. But there are regulations that exist.
Well, how long does it? How long do they?
I believe
have?
It's 30 minutes.
Well, I think it should be zero.
Who does enforce regulations, or whose job is that?
There are enforcement officials that work for Johnson County and Unified Government in Wyandotte County and Jackson County, and the powers are given to them by the state air agencies. So enforcement action is generally taken by state air agencies, or if it's violating a federal standard, EPA may come in at certain points.
Something else Billy brings up that I think is kind of interesting is that she was able to visibly see the difference in air quality with her eyes. And in talking about doing this show, someone mentioned to me that they can see like a brown haze over certain parts of downtown as they drive toward Kansas City. How much of our air quality issue is visible?
When air pollution sort of gathers, and a lot of it's topographical. So if you're in a valley or a low-lying area, you'll probably see it more because the air just sits and it doesn't get cleared out by the wind as quickly. Ozone pollution in and of itself, let me address one thing really quickly. Ozone pollution is not emitted directly from anything. And that's why the doctor that was talking earlier mentioned the hot, sunny days. So ozone pollution is actually formed from a chemical reaction. It sort of bakes in the sun and forms from volatile organic compounds or VOCs and oxides of nitrogen or NOx. And so those hot sunny days are when the pollution has the time to bake in the sun and form through that chemical reaction. So on those days when the wind isn't clearing it out, you may see a haze, and there are sort of pollution cams that the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has on their website where you can view a camera image online and sort of look and see if you can actually physically see the pollution. But ozone itself is a colorless, odorless, tasteless gas. And so it's really the collection of multiple pollutants when you see that haze over the city.
She made a good point. One problem we have is that we have two rivers that come through our city, which is a reason for the city, actually. And that creates a bowl effect and can exacerbate the smog effect.
And we have just a little bit of time, and I want to get in a tweet from one of our listeners who asks, what role do the coal-burning plants in Kansas play in Kansas City's air quality?
Well, historically, the Lacine plant, for example, is 60 miles south of the city, is a major contributor. But they're installing scrubbers right as we speak, so that should be reduced. But like I say, historically, coal-fired power plants, as far as conventional pollutants are concerned, have been probably the biggest contributor. But that's changing now. That again doesn't address climate change, which is carbon dioxide emissions, but. So they're getting better in conventional pollutants.
What does it mean that it doesn't include climate change? Is that something that we need to factor into the discussion?
Well, exactly. The coal-fired power plants remain by far the largest source of carbon dioxide emissions, which is the number one greenhouse gas.
Well, we are running out of time for this particular conversation before we shift gears to discuss Ferguson, Missouri. Amanda Grayer from the Mid-America Regional Council, Craig Voland of the Air Quality Committee and Sierra Club, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Leticia DeCaney, thank you also for sharing your insights as a free agent air quality data collector.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to Central Standard. Now it's time, like every Thursday, to do our Tell KCUR segment with Allison Rawlitz, who's here as our KCUR's social media producer. Good morning, Allison.
Morning, Gina.
We know that a lot of our listeners' minds have really been on Ferguson, Missouri, watching the events unfold there. We've done some reporting and some talk show coverage of those events, but we wanted to know what our listeners were thinking and feeling. So this week's question is about that. Allison, what's the question?
Well, like you said, Gina, there was a lot of conversation going on, but we really wanted to kind of tie this conversation to what's going on in Ferguson, to what's going on the other side of the state. So we asked, what can Kansas City learn from events in Ferguson?
And what kinds of things did we hear back?
Well, there was just a lot of conversation reaction to what was going on. We heard kind of the whole gamut. But when you really kind of focus in on people that answered the question, people really focused their comments on law enforcement, police, kind of lessons they had for the media and reporters. And then there were just some general messages aimed at the community. For instance, I can go ahead and talk about some of the police comments.
Yeah,
received.
Please do.
Sure. From the Twitter handle, Official M. Kusa, I hope I pronounced that correctly. He tweeted us, our police force doesn't need to arm itself like this is Iraq. And that's kind of representative of a lot of comments that we had about just kind of the aggressive police force over in Ferguson.
And that does sound like a response to what they're seeing over there. And mm-hmm. And just so people know, we put in a request from our police department to find out what Kansas City's police department's policy is on crowd control. We haven't heard anything back as of airtime.
Good point, Gina. Good point. We also had Kirk. He tweeted us, Kansas City can learn from the events in Ferguson if local jurisdictions commit to being representative of their populace. And that kind of plays on the fact we had some stories out of St. Louis, reporters really taking a look at the police officers in Ferguson, not ethnically representing the community there. So I think that's what that's in response to. And then another kind of follow-up response from Rebecca on Facebook, the police should know their community and connect with it.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And then as far as the media, I had a lot of comments just kind of complaining the way the media has portrayed Ferguson, Michael Brown, the cops, really everything.
Any lessons for us in that?
Sure. Let me get to that. For some reason, Laura on Facebook, she wrote, there is no good way to report on the death of a young man, but the reporting should be unbiased and fair. And I think probably everyone would agree with that. I also wanted to read a little bit from this email from an unnamed woman. She said, stop focusing solely on the negative. I see stories daily on social media about people blockading stores so they won't be looted. A frat boy is picking up trash from the riots of the peaceful demonstrations that are happening between the upheaval. These stories are absolutely nowhere to be found in the media. Let people know who is doing what. And so her criticism is really that we're seeing a lot of the bad, but all the stuff she's seeing on social media, where's that on TV and in the newspapers and on the radio? And then one woman named Virginia, she emailed us as well. Kind of sent us a lot of comments kind of criticizing the media. And when I asked her, well, what's the lesson for Kansas City media in all this? She wrote, do what the police say. Get off the street. So I think she's talking about some of the arrests that happened and just kind of the reporters that ended up being tear gassed.
Well, Allison, it's surprising to me that so many of the responses that we're hearing sound like they're emphasizing police response to the events and media response to the events. And it doesn't sound like we're hearing a lot about the underlying issues, things people have been discussing like economic inequality and race relations.
You're right. There were some comments on that, but definitely the majority were aimed at institutions. We also had some general community messages I'd like to share from people. We actually had a minister of the Country Club Congregational United Church. He said the Kansas City police should learn from Ferguson that local clergy are essential for peace and mediation between citizens and police. And we also had a man who called in about the political nature of Ferguson.
Yes, the lesson I believe we can all learn from Ferguson is vote. Votes matter. Actions have consequences. Thank you.
So, Allison, that's a pretty succinct message there, isn't it?
Sure, yeah. I really think he's just kind of tapping into that not only has this been just a regular news story, this now has so many political layers to it. And he's just saying if you're unhappy with what's going on, your vote matters.
How can people continue this conversation?
We're still collecting feedback. You can go on our Facebook page or you can tweet us your answer with the hashtag TellKCUR.
Allison, it's been such a pleasure talking with you again. I'm sorry it's about such a sad set of circumstances.
Thank you, Jean. I really appreciate your time.
That's it for today's Central Standard. Tomorrow, Russ Simmons and the Movie Critics will be on the air with movie news and reviews. Don't miss it tomorrow at 10. To listen back to today's show or any previous conversations you've enjoyed on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, along with interns Christina Leffring and Matt Hodapp. And we couldn't do what we do without our board operators. This week we've had lots of help from Michael Byers, Bill Anderson, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's Central Standard. But stick around for Up to Date. They'll be talking with the media critics who will definitely be addressing a lot of what Allison just talked about with the media's response to Ferguson, Missouri. And they'll get the weekend to-do list. That's coming up on Up to Date next.